This is Life Worlds, the place where we explore life through other eyes and minds. Let's flip the script and discover how to orient your world around nature. I'm Alexa Permanish. Come join me as we get down and forage for fungi, stalk coyotes, draft laws for rivers, hum with beehives, sing bird language, and help beavers to dam again. Let these stories spark your reconnection to nature's multiverse. Learn how to bring ecosystems back to life, become an agent for other intelligences, and begin to see how you too are the sum of all life worlds. Hi, everyone. In this episode, it is my explicit intention to change the way that you think about the kingdom of plants. Now, I know that the title of today's show may have been a little bit bizarre. Plant neurobiology? Neurobiology. Surely this is something reserved for those of us who have, well, neurons, a brain, a central nervous system. The field of plant neurobiology was commenced in 2005 when the Society for Plant Neurobiology was formed, aiming to unearth and convey research that plants do perceive and act in an integrated and rather purposeful manner. Today's conversation is going to bring us into the thick of this controversial conversation and debate, with scientists vehemently advocating for or against concepts such as plant intelligence, plant sapience, and even plant consciousness. Now, of course, there is nothing new under the sun, and philosophical speculations on plant consciousness really began at the dawn of time, with ancient civilizations holding their own series of rich beliefs about the sentience and communicative ability of plants. Indeed, many of these beliefs actually underlay their spiritual and cultural and medicinal traditions. Now, in the 19th century, we can really thank good old Charles Darwin, who significantly advanced the study of plant behavior, especially in his 1880 book titled The Power of Movements in Plants, where he argued that plants possess forms of sensitivity and movement that do suggest a form of intelligence. It was actually Darwin who first suggested to the Western world the concept of the root brain hypothesis, where the tips of the plant roots act in some ways like the brain, which we'll be getting to later today. Throughout the 20th and 21st century, research into plant physiology expanded. We have now extensive studies on plants' abilities to respond to environmental stimuli. One thing is for sure, and this is that plants are phenomenally intricate organisms that have adapted a whole set of responses to surviving and thriving on Earth that are really quite extraordinary. Sure, they might not be able to pass a bar exam or play the handpan, although some people have actually begun to make music with the electro-signaling of plants. But as humans, we would, by the way, abysmally fail at many of the exams that plants could put us under. Imagine if I asked you, like a tree, to clone yourself into an 80,000-year-old superorganism. Or like corn, could we really summon wasps to attack caterpillars? Or imagine if Darwin's root brain hypothesis is somewhat correct, that your mouths would be at the tips of your roots and shoots, emitting a language of compounds disseminating through the ecosystem. Plants are able to sense and optimally respond to so many environmental variables: light, water, gravity, temperature, soil structure, nutrients, toxins, microbes, herbivores, chemical signals from other plants, many things that we walk obliviously right past on a day-to-day basis. And they also do curious stuff with a sense of hearing. Monica Gagliano has shown that plants can emit and detect sounds and alter their behavior in response. They can detect the identity of their neighbors even when all modes of sensing are blocked. Her plant research on mimosas seemed to demonstrate a form of individual memory that could not be explained by genetically ingrained behavior, let alone the thrilling question of how they remember stimuli up to 28 days without having a central nervous system. Heidi Apple, an ecologist at the University of Missouri, found that when she played a recording of a caterpillar tromping on a leaf for a plant that hadn't yet been touched, just the sound itself primed the plant's genetic machinery to produce defensive chemicals. And another experiment crazily found that plant roots would seek out a buried pipe through which water was flowing, even if the exterior of the pipe was dry, which suggests that plants can somehow hear the sound of flowing water. And so, as today's guest will share, plants exhibit qualities that are adaptive, flexible, goal-directed, all hallmarks of an intelligence that goes way beyond hardwired, impulsive responses. Plants make decisions. They perform predictive modeling based on their ecosystems. And they do things that we would recognize. They look after their kin. They share nutrients. They can count. They can feel you touching them. Electrical signaling systems have been identified in plants, which are very similar to the nervous systems of animals. And they also have neurotransmitters like dopamine and melatonin. This is actually, for me, not dissimilar to our conversation with Carl Safina some episodes ago, where we discussed animal culture, and that culture itself is a phenomenon that is widespread in animal societies, not just uniquely human. There is some arrogance, I think, in us believing that we are the only species to experience the worlds of emotion, thought, culture, and, of course, intelligence. Plants really make us wonder whether intelligence and consciousness require a brain. Should we maybe consider consciousness to be less brain-bound, more held within a keen ability to respond in real time to a shifting earth? And for that matter, does intelligence really reside in the individual self or in the enmeshment of the ecosystem of which it constitutes a whole? A sort of swarm intelligence, a networked mind, distributive, adaptive, like a murmuration of starlings in the setting sun. Bacterial colonies exhibit similar traits, like collective memory and adaptive problem-solving. They're colonies more like brain-like structures, performing versions of supercomputation. Gregory Bateson has said that each organism is a unit of mind, a holon integrated into a wider Gaian mind. Lynn Margulis speaks of symbiosis. One thing is for sure again, the world is much more networked and brilliantly knowing than it might initially appear. I would argue that our society in many ways is plant blind. We have forgotten how to perceive and know this kingdom of life that quite literally brings us the building blocks of existence. It also takes bravery to recognize some of the concepts we're going to discuss today, because facing them head on brings up ethical dilemmas on our current utilitarian and sometimes violent use of plants and other species, questions which are arguably uncomfortable but critically important. Our guest today, Paco Calvo, is one of the brave leaders in this space, a renowned cognitive scientist and philosopher of biology, known for his groundbreaking research in the field of plant cognition and intelligence. He is a professor at the University of Murcia in Spain, where he leads the Minimal Intelligence Lab, MINT Lab, focused on the studying of minimal cognition in plants. His lab combines insights from biology, philosophy, and cognitive science to explore plant behavior, decision-making, and problem-solving, challenging some of the more conventional perspectives of his field. Paco has once said that to know thyself, one has to think beyond oneself, or even one species. One can only know thyself by knowing others, by thinking ourselves into the experiences of other organisms dramatically different from us, however rudimentary or complex they might be. So, holding that philosophy as a torch throughout this episode, come with a curious mind and heart, doubt the facts, but also face the possibility that there is much more to our plant kin than meets the eye. Over to Paco. Paco, hello. Welcome to Life Worlds.
Hi, Alexa. Nice to see you.
Pleasure to have you on the show. You're speaking to us from Spain, I believe.
Yeah, southeast Spain, Murcia in the southeast of Spain. Beautiful weather right now, starting springtime.
Before the summer heat sets in, right? You can enjoy it well.
Yeah.
There's a period of the year where the windows are open and then they become closed.
You know well, right? You know what you're talking about.
Well, Paco, one of the things that strikes me about the uniqueness of your work in your lab is that you're also inside of a philosophy department versus just an ecology department. Therefore, I'm going to start us off with some philosophy. And I think it's quite an apt place to begin, because you said in your book, and I'm going to quote quite extensively from your book during this interview, we are so entrenched, you have written, we are so entrenched in the dogma of neuronal intelligence and brain-centric consciousness. And it's tricky, right? Because in a way, humans, we love to be the arbiters of what we think is consciousness, what we think is intelligence. And we rank other species in ways by like things that we think that we're good at or our own models, right? And I've always wondered, and it was a reason for this podcast, like, why should intelligence look and be similar to ours? Why can't it be completely different? Why does it need a brain? Why does it need a central nervous system? Plants can do so many things that we can't do, right? And so one of the things in your book that really got me thinking is, you write, we can't see consciousness or intelligence. We can perceive behaviors. But in a way, like, how could we even know consciousness if it was right in front of us? So I want us to start there. The title of your book is Planta Sapiens, right? Plant intelligence. So first of all, are we talking about plant consciousness when we're talking about intelligence? Or sort of how would you play around with those definitions?
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks for having me and thanks for these first questions. You brought a few themes in there, right? I mean, that was not just a question. There's a few questions already there. And they are all really interesting. I mean, all the way from, yes, let's accept it. We started working on plant intelligence within a philosophy department. And that's important to bear in mind, because what we are able to do is to raise the type of questions that haven't been raised, or at least until today, have not been raised from, you know, orthodox mainstream quarters in plant biology or in cognitive psychology. People weren't asking these questions. That's why we needed to pull out and have a fresh look at the issue. The issue is plant intelligence. As you will say, plant intelligence and plant sentience are not quite the same thing. So put it this way, you might encounter a form of life that is smart, that is intelligent to some extent, and that could be, for all we know, a zombie devoid of sentience, right? You could be intelligent without having a subjective sense of awareness. You could be sentient and yet rather stupid.
Like many humans that we know.
Yeah, maybe. So those two things, by necessity, they don't need to come together. A different issue is whether when we find one, we tend to find the other. They might come in tandem, but not by necessity. That's an empirical fact of the matter to be discovered scientifically, right? So here we are encountering two different questions. Are plants intelligent? And then a second question is, are plants sentient? Do they have their own subjective sense of awareness, right? And you are right. As we say in Planta Sapiens, the very first thing to bear in mind is that, think about it, intelligence or sentience is something that we cannot observe directly. But I don't mean to say that we cannot observe directly because it's plants we are talking about. No, no, we cannot observe directly human intelligence and human sentience. So intelligence or sentience of any organism whatsoever is something that you can only infer. You have to reach the conclusion that this form of life I'm encountering, I'm observing, I'm studying, is intelligent or is sentient, provided that is the best explanation to come to terms with the type of behavior it exhibits. So they exhibit the pattern, certain patterns of behavior, the overt behavior we see in the case of plants through time-lapse photography. For example, we do in our lab, right? We time-lapse plants, we speed them up, and then we say, hey, look at that. I mean, that's a pretty sophisticated pattern of behavior. Does it deserve the label intelligent? Because it could be a stupid behavior. So what sort of behaviors are intelligent and what sort of behaviors are dumb? So you see, so these are all questions that we need to tackle on a one-to-one basis without prejudice. So without preconceptions as to which forms of life deserve or can be intelligent or sentient at all. That's the first point you raise about we providing the gold standard. Why should humans provide any gold standard? Why do we need to compare their smarts to ours? They could be doing things in complete different ways and yet be intelligent, right?
And so when you say, you know, we can look at their behaviors and see if they're intelligent, what kinds of behaviors in plants have us believe that?
We can even make the question broader or wider. We can say, what sort of behaviors deserve to be called intelligent in plants, in bacteria, in fungi, in protists, in animals, so in the tree of life, right? I mention this because otherwise we might be thinking that we are looking for some specific signature of plant intelligence. And I would like to think that we are looking for signatures of intelligence in the tree of life as such, right? What it takes for a bacteria to be intelligent or for a plant or for a fungus. But let's talk plants, right? Mm-hmm. First thing to bear in mind for listeners to visualize them is that when we speak of plant behavior, we need to understand that their behavior cannot translate into patterns of locomotion or displacement as we are used to observing in the case of animals, like, you know, a squirrel running around in my garden or you and I walking to the shop to buy food, whatever. So locomotion is not the name of their game. The name of their game is growth and development, right? So they go through different developmental stages, but development as such is not intelligent behavior. It's just a developmental pattern that they go through. So we need to distinguish what sort of patterns are behavioral rather than simply forms of development, and within those, which are smart or intelligent patterns of behavior, right? Mm-hmm. So the patterns of behavior that we care about in plants or that we study in the lab are those that, in a sense, are not simply pre-programmed routines, something that could be simply coded in the genes, that their genetic makeup could account for what they do, like, you know, like a automatic, you know, phototropic response. Oh, plants turn towards light. Oh, yes. Well, oh, yes. That's a great adaptation, sure. I mean, they need light to make up their own food, right, through photosynthesis. But we couldn't say they are smart because they turn towards light. That's just a smart adaptation. And as such, a behavior that is adaptive by itself doesn't constitute intelligence. So we need to add something on top of a behavior being adaptive, right? Adaptive behavior has got to be flexible enough. It's got to be flexible enough because plants or any organism whatsoever, they need to reevaluate, reassess the conditions in their surroundings. Because what I did yesterday, maybe it was a good choice what I did yesterday, but maybe it's the wrong choice tomorrow because things have changed in the meanwhile. So things are not constant, static. There are changes, fluxes of energy changing around the clock, 24/7. And what was good news yesterday might be bad news tomorrow. So we need to keep changing gear and reassessing and reevaluating and thinking, hey, does it still pay off to grow in this direction? Does it still pay off to emit these volatiles into the open air? Does it still pay off to team up with these other guys, with this fungi, to establish this patterns of collaboration? Maybe what was fruitful or useful yesterday is not anymore. So behavior, apart from being adaptive, has got to be flexible enough to change gear, to change course of action. And if you think about it, we might still think that a pattern of behavior that is adaptive and flexible still doesn't deliver the goods. Because you might be behaving flexibly but in a reactive manner, simply responding to a stimuli, right? A source of a stimulation impinging on my sensory surface, thereby I respond. And no, what makes you smart is not the fact that you can respond flexibly and fast, but rather the fact that you can respond anticipatorily, ahead of time, you see? So that's truly important because plant behavior unfold in a time scale in which being so slow compared to animals, right? They don't have muscles, they don't have nervous tissue, they cannot respond in a fast manner the way we do. So precisely because they are so slow in the way they grow towards their targets, in a sense, it is truly pressing for them to evolve patterns of behavior that are predictive of the future, that can think ahead of time. Because think about it. If you grow in the wrong direction and it takes you 3 days to get there, you don't want to find out that you were growing in the wrong direction once it's too late. Oh my God, I was running, or in this case, growing to catch the train to the wrong train station. And it took me 3 days to get there. So if you're slow, if your mode of life is slow by definition, you grow as a plant does, you want to make sure you have made the right choices ahead of time before it's too late. So those are the behaviors we are interested in. Behaviors that are goal-directed, by the way, so that they are directing a target. They want to reach a goal. Think of a vine or a climbing plant. They want to reach a host tree or a pole or some target to twine around and grow up there and do photosynthesis. But to do that, they've got to think ahead of time. Hey, not I don't want to get there because the sun is the one I need right now. It's the one I will need when I get there in the future. And things will change. So that's what I mean by behaving flexibly, anticipatorily, and in a goal-directed manner. All this adds up to a mere adaptive behavior.
That's super clear. Yeah, I remember when I was watching the time-lapse videos, and I'm going to put some in the show notes. And I found quite a few. Also, the one of the plants that goes with its suckers. And like when we do speed it up, it has that like goal-directed, anticipatory kind of behavior. And it's interesting what you say. So an adaptation or an impulse or something that's automatic or hardwired isn't necessarily a sign of this intelligent life. You know, when I was reading the book, I was thinking about humans, like, and actually how many of our behaviors are completely hardwired and automatic, and we're just responding to our environment without intelligence. I mean, we go towards sugars or fats in our foods. We have pheromones dictating what we're attracted to. We get triggered by, you know, our limbic system and technology or colors in the supermarket. And so in that way, like...
dopamine boost.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so I just think it's really interesting that a lot of human behaviors are not decisions. And yet it's really important to us to see other animals making decisions. But I think it's also important to double click that many times humans, we're not really making decisions, even though we think we are. And something else as well that I thought about as I was reading is there's this sort of flexible, anticipatory, goal-directed behavior that you and your lab and the other scientists you're working with are showing. And I remembered you mentioned that one individual can learn in its lifetime versus like this generational knowledge.
Yeah.
Is that also part of it, that like one character, if you will, in a story, one vine will have its own evolutionary journey? Is that also related to intelligence?
Oh, definitely. It's got to be. Otherwise, we would be giving the gold medal to evolution as such. And we want to give the prize to the individual. But why? Because whatever you and I, Alexa, in your context, whatever is happening in your surroundings, or Paco in my own surroundings, whatever we do, of course, it has something to do with our genes. But it has to do with what I had for breakfast this morning, whether I had some coffee before this interview, whatever. What I've gone through my life as an individual. And those patterns of past experiences are shaping up who I am and why I behave the way I do. So we wouldn't be able to talk about learning if not, right? So two individuals with the same genotype, one exposed to some training regime and the other exposed to a different training regime or no training at all, will behave completely differently having the same genotype. So it has to do with the individual, with what the individual as such has been exposed to. And that's very important because it allows us to put the focus on the plant as an agent, as an individual, as what's happening to me, not to the species as such. Oh, climbing beans or climbing plants or vines or carnivorous plants. No, no, I don't behave the way I do because I belong to this species. I behave the way I do because I was exposed to something yesterday and the day before yesterday and the day before yesterday. So that's what explains the idiosyncrasies, the differences in behavior. And that's what makes of me a unique individual.
In the book, maybe, you know, anthropomorphizing is an interesting concept because humans are not the only species. And I had Carl Safina on the podcast and we spoke about animal cultures, right? We didn't invent joy, anger, sadness. I mean, this has existed throughout the animal kingdom out of the tree of life of which we emerge. So in my way of speaking about the world, I'm comfortable with a bit of anthropomorphizing because it's actually just we are exhibiting the behaviors that exist out there. But maybe this might be different to how you want to express it. But I do mention some, I do remember something in the book that we're starting to find that animals obviously have different personalities and that really affects the way that they forage and the way that evolution happens.
Sure.
Is it the same in plants that they have actually these individual personalities?
Yeah, definitely. So there are two issues here. One is with the very way we speak of the risk of anthropomorphization, because in fact, this is two risks associated. So on the one hand, you have the risk of inflating plant behavior up, beefing it up, as saying, hey, you're anthropomorphizing plants unnecessarily. You don't need to posit these properties to explain plant physiology, to explain plant life. Many people would tell you, right? But on the other hand, you have the opposite risk of missing truly smart plant behaviors with the obsession of not beefing them up.
Mm-hmm.
So the best way to deal with this or to strike a right balance in between both risks is to forget about ourselves. And this has to do with this navel-gazing attitude that I speak of in the preface of Planta Sapiens. If you recall, in the preface, I say something like, look, we are obsessed with ourselves, but we are not that special. We shouldn't be providing the gold standard. And if we stop navel-gazing, we wouldn't have this need to say, hey, plants are smart, but watch out. Don't describe the way the plant is climbing or reaching for the pole as if it was a cowboy lassoing, that sort of metaphors. So when are we speaking metaphorically and when are we not?
Mm-hmm.
That is the question, right? But if you think about it, speaking of personality, animal personality or plant personality, it shouldn't represent any danger to our sense of human personality. Because if we think that we are not that special and we take seriously the message of finding what unites us all in the tree of life, this has to do with something which is pretty simple and pretty obvious. Like two different bacteria will swim up a sugar gradient in a petri dish differently depending on what they've been exposed to and what their needs are. So think of a mimosa. You know, Mimosa pudica, the one that you touch and it falls to the naked eye. You don't even need to do time lapse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you just watch it falling because it falls in our temporal scale of observation. You see it dropping its leaves, right? So when you see the mimosa, when you touch it and it falls its leaves, that's anything but the hardwired reflex. Why? Because depending on the need that the individual plant has for foraging, for light, nutrients, whatever, depending on the level of stress it's being exposed to, it will find that it is worth to take the risk of not folding and avoiding taking photons. So I'd rather, you know, if I have plenty of energy stored, I might say, okay, you know, maybe this was a herbivore, maybe this was Paco touching me in the lab. I'll just fold just in case. But sometimes you can't afford just in case, to fold just in case, because you are missing precious minutes of sunlight. And we see that plants exposed to different levels of stress will behave differently. So this is anything but a hardwired response.
It's very unique to the plant. Yeah. And then...
Yeah, definitely.
And then you also wrote that the plants have some kind of self-recognition capacity, some territory guarding capacity.
Yeah.
That they kind of make these internal maps of their environment and how to even move through obstacles before encountering them. Like this for me is a quality of mind of some sort.
Yeah. When you find resistance in the, you know, the scientific community, it has to do with what you just said. You said, oh, this to me equates to having a mind. You know what the problem is? Is that we think we understand what it takes to have a mind because we can't help but think of a mind as what we do have, right?
Mm-hmm.
Human mentality. Oh, somebody's sitting at the wheel, somebody's doing the driving. But what do we mean to say when we say that somebody's sitting at the driving seat in Paco's head? Is there a little Paco doing the driving in my head? Of course, that's nonsense. We know it's nonsense. It's just a way of speaking, but we can't help but to think that there is an agent, that there is somebody at the wheel deciding to turn left or to turn right or to change gear. And that cannot possibly be the case, because if I crack open your skull or my skull, I won't find any of that. I will see a huge distributed system for processing information. We call it a brain and a neocortex and a prefrontal cortex. And all this talk you mentioned before about, oh, we rationalize things. We think that we have these narratives in our minds and we say, oh, I decided to do this because I thought that was the best course of action or I was thirsty. That's why I decided to go and grab a glass of water. So we make up our minds and construct all these narratives, linguistic narratives. And we think that mind boils down to those narratives. But that's just an illusion. We are as decentralized as plants, right?
And actually, that brings me to one of the next points, which is you speak about extended cognition in the book, right? The way that I think about it is like you have a spider in a spider web. It sounds a bit cheesy when I say it like this, but where does the spider begin and the web end? Because in a way, that web is the spider's extended cognition, because if there's a little vibration here, it'll dash in. And so I think in similar ways, we're a bit more numbed to it as human beings because of our upbringing and we're constantly assaulted by our senses. But the environment, in a way, is where the intelligence and the mind resides. And I think that plants, like, distinctly really, really help us understand that. Maybe you can speak a little bit to how you describe that in the book.
Absolutely. I love this motto. Comes from ecological psychology. I mentioned this in the book. I say, look, what counts is not what's inside the head, but what the head is inside of. Put it another way. If you want to understand intelligence or sentience, you cannot pretend to understand it by looking at what's happening within the skull or within the individual. Why? Because the unit of analysis, the one and only unit of analysis, is not the organism, but the organism coupled to the environment. So it's a coupled system. An organism without an environment, even a brain without a body, makes no sense. It's the coupled system as such what we are studying, right? So the fact that plants are fully decentralized, it's simply a result of evolution. So think, some people say, plants can afford to be stupid because they are rooted, they are sessile, you know, they can afford to be stupid. But we, animals, that need to be fast and respond, you know, and hide and hunt and go shopping and cook dinner, we cannot afford to be stupid. We've got to be on the move. And we've got to be fast. That's why we evolve brain, muscles, nervous tissue. But plants being rooted, they can afford to be stupid. Put it this way, it's precisely the other way around. So you could say, no, how smart they've got to be to keep passing their genes without being able to run away, to hide, all these things we animals do. And the name of the game, so the trick in their case, is not to locate anything essential in one specific spot. So I only have a heart or two lungs or two kidneys, and I better protect them if I find a predator rushing towards me, right? But I can flee, I can confront the attacker, whatever. But plants, since they cannot do that, the strategy they found is to have everything fully decentralized. So there is not a specific place where you will find the heart or the lungs or the kidneys. So if you chop a branch off, they will grow another branch, so to speak. This means, to me, the lesson is that if you think about it, we are way more animals. We human and non-human animals are way more decentralized than we thought we were. So cognition, human cognition, doesn't boil down to the activity of the brain. It has to do with non-neural bodily aspects and environmental interactions with those bodily aspects coupled to a brain. So it's the sum of it all. It's the emergent outcome of those all those interactions taking place in between a body, neural tissue, and the local environment. And only in this way we can understand how sentience or mentality emerges. It emerges out of this coupling, the very coupling.
I think what's incredible about the kind of work that you're doing and this way of seeing the world, and I want to get into that next, it's like part of the mentality that gets us into perpetuating a lot of problems and not really fixing the problems that we've created is because we break things down into little pieces. So we think the brain is in the mind. We think that the plant is just the plant. And, you know, obviously I'm now looking out at the forest in front of my home and like it's in many ways, multiple organisms becoming one intelligent organism. And if we see it, so it's the seeing in the wholes and not the parts. And I think that plants show us that. So concluding like this piece of what we're talking about is like, just because something doesn't have a brain doesn't mean it doesn't have intelligence or awareness in ways that are really quite astounding. And then secondly, that leads me to say, well, what else are we blind to because of our biases in our thinking, right? Especially as you've emphasized like this evolutionary kind of visual system where we needed to look at things quickly, et cetera. And so in your book, you speak about Paul Churchland, who maybe some people haven't heard of, who's a philosopher. And in your book, you know, he says that our imaginations are capable of dramatic leaps into other worlds, especially when coupled with a plentiful scientific understanding. And then you say, We need to think outside of our own narrow intuitions of what is relevant in our environments and try to imagine it from another type of consciousness.
Mm, absolutely.
Like bats living in a dark world that illuminated by sonar, or, you know, Ed Young's book, An Immense World, right? Like plants are drawn to the nourishment or sunlight or mineral riches of soil. So my question to you is, you know, not only really what are we blind to, because I think we've been talking a little bit about that, but how do we need to, and maybe how do you and the people in your lab, for example, learn to see and perceive the world in a different way to enter into the world of plants?
Mm. Well, that's very interesting. I think this takes us back to the very first question on why did you found your lab, or why you got, you know, to do all this research from within a philosophy department. And you know what? Something that worries me is that sometimes we are unable to appreciate other walks of life, paradoxically, because we know too much, because we are experts in our fields. And the more we know, the more we know, the more experts we become, the more we miss.
Mm.
And that's paradoxical, but it's true. So put it this way, I love one way in which this was put in a different context. Let me give you some background. Remember Orson Welles' Citizen Kane? It was the first film Orson Welles made, right? Coming from theater. He was 25 or something, was young, and he just did this masterpiece that changed the whole history of cinema. And, you know, a couple of decades later, he was being interviewed by a BBC journalist, and this guy told him, hey, how were you able to accomplish this? Because it was a revolution. It was truly revolutionary on all fronts, like the soundtrack, the script, the camera movements. Everything about it was just a before and an after Citizen Kane with respect to what had been done before, right? And he was only 25. So the BBC journalist was like, how were you able to do that? You've got to be a genius. So you've got to be able to envisage every single possibility, see everything that had been done, and find the gap and fill it with what is still missing, right? And Orson Welles was like puzzled. I said, what are you talking about? I was able to do that because I was ignorant. Not because I was an expert, but precisely the opposite. Because I knew so little cinema that I didn't know that this was not expected to be done. You see?
Yeah.
It's such a powerful intuition. Because sometimes, if you are in a plant physiology department, if you're a professor of physiology, and you know all the tiny details about these light-sensitive proteins reacting to this part of the light wave spectrum, oh, this responds to blue light, this responds to red light, this does that, and this signaling pathway, and this. If you know all the physiological nuts and bolts, you might be such an expert that you lose the connection. You don't get to see the big picture. And what is the big picture in this case? Well, think just this example of plants responding to different parts of the light spectrum. When the climbing plant is targeting a host tree or a pole or something, or when you ask how does a plant know whether there is a lot of other plants in the vicinity or is a good place to grow into because there's plenty of sunlight or there is competition for sunlight, you know what the plant is doing? The plant is processing the ratio, the proportion of red to far red light, because plants are absorbing red and plants are reflecting far red light, right? So if I'm growing in this direction, and I see the ratio plummeting, it means that over here, there are more guys absorbing red. Oh, that's bad news. I'd rather move in the other direction. If I grow in the other direction and now the ratio goes up, again, to 1-1, it means, oh, less people absorbing red. Empty space. I'd rather grow in this direction. So just an example that gives you something that goes beyond the physiological understanding of the working of those proteins. Why? Because first, it allows you to understand that you cannot possibly study intelligence pressing pause. So I couldn't just watch a photogram, and try to understand what's happening there, because intelligence, behavior unfolds in time. So I couldn't be sitting here and processing whether there is a lot of competition to my left or to my right, unless I grow in that direction and see what the effect of growth towards my left has on the ratio. Oh, as I grow to my right, the ratio drops. As I grow to my right, the ratio goes up. You see? So you need to see, that's an example of seeing that information is not within the organism, it's in the couple system. So what's happening in my surroundings as I behave, as I move, as I grow towards them or against, away from them, right? From those targets. And that's a way to see that many times knowing less allows you to put yourself in the shoes of other species. One thing is through this exercise of not residing or not resorting to the knowledge of the experts, because they might be missing other ways to approach the problem, right? But also, and this is very important, going back to the idea of anthropomorphizing them, you've got to drop the idea that whatever they are doing, they will be doing that because, in a sense, they've got to exploit their five senses, as if they had to have something equivalent to our five senses. We don't know what senses they have. So to put yourself in their shoes, you must, by necessity, you need to forget about the way you monitor your surroundings, because that just happens to be one way in which you can be sensitive to your environment, to your local environment. But other forms of life will exploit different forms of information, and those forms of information might relate to the speed at which they are growing, to see how those ratios go up or down, and many, many other things. So we need to truly forget about ourselves. Otherwise, we won't get it.
I mean, this is almost just like a life lesson in general. I think in most situations, even if you're dealing with like your parents-in-law, it requires a lot of ontological humility, right? And you actually shared a few things there about the skills. So there is this element of kind of knowing less and intuition combined with like a beginner's mind. Then there was this element of maybe when you're in that space, understanding that movement occurs just on very different time scales. Mm-hmm. Then you mentioned a third piece, which was sort of, you see the coupled systems. So I like soften my eyes. I'm not focusing on one thing. I'm focusing on a wider scope. Mm-hmm. The way that I experienced this when I was reading about the vines and the plants, I can't remember if you wrote about this in the book, but if I like removed the fact that I had ever seen a plant ever, and I was just like seeing it for the first time, kind of beginner's mind, it's a bit like the octopus. For me, I see like all these little heads, all these little brains in the tentacles and the shoots, whether it's like underground in the mycelium or it's overground. There's multiple brains and they're all kind of like seeking into the world and they're all extending into the world. And that's like the way I've started seeing plants is like on their tips. And it's just like these little minds or hands like seeking out, which I don't know. I think it's quite interesting. And then another way that I was thinking about it, something you wrote about in your book made me think this. It's like, so how do plants speak? Now, if we remove the human, I speak by doing this thing with my voice to you right now. You've said it, and I think I've read it elsewhere as well, that like plants speak through the volatiles that they emit, through the compounds, through the pheromones, this communication. And I think you even said, let me see if it's, I have the quote here. Plants speak the silent language of scents. They do it through their leaves, shoots, and roots, through their flowers and fruits. Virtually all plants have mastered the tricks. I love this of chemical talk because it is a language, synthesizing and releasing many different volatiles, VOCs. And I love this part where you said, we may picture each volatile as a building block in the vocabulary of plants, with words being many different compounds like Lego, right? And that there's over 1,700 different cocktails. That's also really cool. It's like, oh yeah, plants are speaking. It's just a different type of language.
We just miss it. We just miss it because we are obsessed with language-like thought, so propositional mental structures. So it's so harmful to think in loud voice as we Homo sapiens do, because we think that by default, any form of life that is able to think has got to do it likewise. And there are so many different communication channels. One is volatiles, sure, but not only volatiles. I mean, it could be, you know, electrochemical communication, vibrational cues. We've been listing like for a long time the parameters, the different biotic and abiotic parameters that plants can be sensitive to, you know, light, gravity, chemicals, magnetic fields, toxics, whatever, you name it. And the list is growing and growing and growing. So it's 20 plus 30 different parameters. They've got to be integrating all that information and providing a response that is adaptive at a global level, right? So it's chemical and many other things on top of that. But what's more important is that in relation to the first part of your question, you were speaking of, oh, okay, different individuals, the different tips, their shoes, the roots. Even the very notion, the very idea of an individual is lost.
Mm.
It doesn't translate easily. It's something more akin to a form of swarm intelligence or collective intelligence, you know, like a flock of birds, school of fish, something like that. Like the plant is not really an individual, it's a collectivity. So communication is inter-organismic in a way.
Why is it not an individual? Just to double click on that.
Yeah, well, because every little tip, branch, it has its own command center.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Because they are fully decentralized, they have like all these separate modules, and from each root tip, each shoot tip, they are monitoring, sensing the environment, and orchestrating it all, putting it all together. So what the roots are doing is going to have an effect, is going to have a bearing upon what the shoots are doing and vice versa. That doesn't mean that they are not connected or that they are not an individual. It's a confederation, it's a republic of individuals.
I love that.
Yeah. The same way we speak of ourselves as centralized humans, like with a, you know, vertical structure,
mm-hmm.
plants in that sense are like more horizontal, more republican. We speak of the monarchic animal versus the republican plant. It's more a horizontal level of coordination in between individual units. Now, is it a community? Is it an individual? It doesn't really matter because of communication. What counts is that communication is being rehearsed and retrained round the clock, in order for the whole system, call it a community or not, to provide responses that make sense at the global scale,
mm-hmm.
right? So, yeah, we just need to forget about us providing the right sort of metrics. And then we won't see them as that weird, that awkward. They are not awkward anymore if we forget that we are supposed to provide the standard.
I love that it's weird, though, because it kind of it creates this like, no, but it's true, because it creates this fascination and awe that actually I think humans need to kind of wake up to what's around us, right?
Yeah.
Something that I thought was weird and trippy and cool was when you spoke about the neurotransmitters in the book.
Mm.
And that plants, like, they have dopamine, they have serotonin, they have melatonin.
Glutamate, GABA.
They can get jet lag, and that they produce certain chemicals when they're stressed. It could be painkillers. Are they experiencing emotions because they're like responding and creating neurotransmitters like we do?
Yeah, well, that's woof. Again, so many different things you touched upon. So yeah, now great. I mean, these are all great topics. But first, I mean, jet lag, I love that topic because that's precisely one project we are working on at the moment. You see, this is a great example to understand why what we spoke before about the experts in plant physiology missing what's at stake. So think of phytomelatonin, right? So melatonin, you know, melatonin is what allows us to go back in sync with the day-night cycles, things like this. In fact, many human adults, when they, you know, are finding it hard to crash, to go to sleep, what do? They sometimes take a melatonin pill, right? Plants do that naturally. So they biosynthesize their phytomelatonin, the same molecule, right? You see, in fact, the same peak. So when the sun sets, they have the melatonin rise up, then during the day it wears off. So the very same time evolution or profile you find in plants and animals. And yet, if I see a legume, you know, legumes like climbing beans, they fold their leaves at night, right? When the sun, mm-hmm. the lights go off, they fold their leaves. People have a hard time thinking that they are going to bed or that they are falling asleep, right? But if they thought about it, the profile of the behavior, the concentration of phytomelatonin mimics exactly the same temporal profile as it happens in animals. Now, if you are not a reductionist plant physiologist and you have this more holistic perspective, you can think, why plants cannot be jet lagged? In fact, that's what we do. We induce jet lag to plants. So we shift the photoperiod in the lab. So you can shift the photoperiod such that the lights don't go off when they were supposed to go off. The same as if you're crossing the pond mm-hmm. and then get to DF in Mexico or New York City, whatever. And then, oh, you know, the time zone changed. I was supposed to go to bed. Something is funny here. A couple of days to get rid of your jet lag, right? And I bet you that if you were flying, crossing the pond with a pet, a dog or a cat, I bet you would think, oh, my poor cat, my poor dog, it might be suffering from jet lag the same way I do.
Mm-hmm.
Because for your pet, it's also supposed to be nighttime and it's daytime or vice versa. But if you were carrying a potted plant with you, you wouldn't think the same. You would never think that the plant is jet lag. Well, it is. But now this is the important point. This is not a metaphor. When we say that the plant is jet lagged as your pet, we mean it literally at the physiological level. So you can see how their phytomelatonin is changing as ours does. It's not in sync with the day-night cycle. In fact, that's one thing we are doing. We are applying exogenous melatonin to see whether that reduces the type of stress induced by the change of the photoperiod.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, these examples allows you to see that this is not a way of speaking, that physiologically speaking, the very same molecular clocks, nuts and bolts, runs the wheel, explains how any form of life whatsoever ticks to the solar clock, responds to the day-night cycles, because this is not a coincidence. Any form of life whatsoever in the tree of life can pick information that is extremely informative. In this case, regularities that happen around the clock. Oh, the sun sets, the sun rises, temperature drops, temperature goes up, relative humidity drops, relative humidity. So all these things happen around the clock for any form of life on planet Earth. So any form of life whatsoever will be sensitive to those changes, plants included.
I think for most people, I mean, myself included, when I first learned about it, to know that plants actually have many of the same neurotransmitters, like, you know, we said melatonin, but also dopamine, etc. It's just, if we know that we are a cocktail of emotions due to these things, and then we can't see the consciousness, the intelligence of plants, but we know that they're creating these compounds and they elicit something in us, why wouldn't they elicit in them? It's an interesting, and it's funny you spoke about the houseplant, because, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is, like, as people study a subject, how do they change? And obviously, like, you change throughout all of the course of your research. And one of the things I remember is you were speaking about houseplants and you said something about how, like, maybe we can stop seeing them as ornamental objects, but actually as, like, dudes who are sharing, like, a space with us.
We should.
Right? Because they're, like, just as responsive and sensitive than we are.
Yeah. We keep missing it.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we are so stubborn, so incredibly stubborn, that you know what is the response I have gotten? This is published. In response to the idea of plants using glutamate or GABA as neurotransmitters. The response coming from mainstream plant physiology is to say, no, those molecules cannot be neurotransmitters in plants. Because if you go to the dictionary and look up the word neurotransmitter, it is connected to the notion of a synapse. So if plants have no synapses because there are no neurons, there is no need to bridge in between neurons through a synapse, right? So there is no need for neurotransmitters or chemical bridging. So think about it. Instead of revising our definitions in the dictionary, we set them in stone and are enslaved by them, turn the blind eye to the evidence that is telling us that plants are resorting to those same molecules for signaling purposes. So plants are using glutamate and GABA to allow for a spread of a calcium wave to activate throughout the plant. So a systemic response to stress.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are inducing some form of stress on this part of the plant and you see this calcium wave spreading throughout the plant triggered by glutamate, you don't want to call that a neurotransmitter because the dictionary tells you there are no synapses and there should be synapses.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't it more smart to simply revise our definitions to make them more encompassing? When we don't do that, we end up treating our potted plants at home as ornamental objects because we cannot picture them as agents, as subjects in the business of meaning-making what's going on in their surroundings the very same way we do.
And you wrote about this as well, and I agree because, you know, I do some investment in the sort of nature space in one of my roles. And yeah, like speaking about these plant beings as resources or assets, it's the same type of instrumentalization. Instead of like, can we partner with nature? Can we work with the forest? It's like, we will use the forest to capture the thing that's important to us, which is carbon or, you know, non-timber food products, whatever it may be. So there is this instrumentalizing, and there's two things I want to get to before we sign off. I want to talk about the biorobotics and the ethics, which we're starting to touch on. But first, the biorobotics, because I think it also has to do with how we kind of see or perceive differently. I hadn't come across this before, actually, your work. If I understand it correctly, it's looking now not just at the animal world of how we create these kind of, you know, crazy robots, or, you know, the insect world and how we make like flying drones, but it's, can we look at the plant world and how we make robotics? Can you speak a little bit to your work in that?
Yeah. So we had this project on plant intelligence for robotics and AI. And this means that we can bio-inspire our robotics and our AIs on plant models and not on animal models. So that's one of the examples I use in the book. Maybe this is a bit of a spoiler, but I think it's a clear-cut example. It's like, you know, just think of a rover on Mars. What's a rover? A rover is just a tiny robot on wheels that scouts around, is cruising the landscape. You know, it's like a geologist, like picking samples from the terrain, whatever. So what's the problem for the rover? That it's got to negotiate its surroundings. It's got to navigate through, avoid obstacles, to go from point A to point B. And all the problems NASA or any space agency has in controlling the behavior of these robots is that many things can go wrong as they move from point A to point B. So if I'm on wheels and I need to get there to sample the terrain, I might find a crack in between, or a sand dune, or an inclination of 30 degrees, or a cliff, you know. Many, many things could go wrong. And all these are problems that have to do with anticipating contingencies, with engineers trying to program ahead of time what might go wrong such that the rover knows what to do, right? And that's a crazy game. That's a lost game. Because by definition, you cannot possibly anticipate the whole set of things that could go wrong such that you can put them into code for the software to be exploited by the rover. And we want a robot, a rover in this case, that is autonomous, that can, you know, do its own business and without waiting for you to say from planet Earth, hey, turn left, turn right, watch out, right? They've got to be autonomous. Now, you have two ways to do it. Either to implement and feed it as much as possible with learning algorithms and trying to make it understand the sort of problems it might encounter, or you might do away with those problems in one shot by, for example, growing and not moving from A to B. So think about it. If you grow from A to B rather than locomote, I don't care about the crack because my wheel is not going to stuck into the crack. I just grow over the crack. Think of a hanging bridge. I don't care about the strength of the stream. I just, like a hanging bridge, I reach the other riverbank, right? So if I'm growing as a robot that grows, we call it a growbot, a robot that grows. So a growbot will grow over the crack, will grow across the cliff, hanging from the cliff edge, will grow on top of the sand dune, will grow over the 30 degrees inclination. So the growbot, the robot that grows, doesn't care about your problems because your problems are tailor-made for an agent that locomotes to move from point A to point B. So you see, we are not adding extra lines of code. We are changing the problem space.
It's quite scary, though, if you would imagine like these growbots like slowly coming into like your homes, or, you know, like they're coming. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's same technology can be used for anything. I just had this like dystopic image of this like robot coming in through the doors.
Well, remember before we spoke about each root tip or shoot tip being one individual. So you wouldn't be sampling the terrain by getting there and drilling and getting a sample because you are sampling extendedly. Mm-hmm. So you have multiple sensors sampling in parallel at once. So you are covering the terrain and sampling both at point A and at point B.
Yeah.
So that means you can temporarily take samples in situ simultaneously rather than, hey, I need to get there. I'm going to see what happens there when I get there tomorrow. So this is, simultaneous sampling of the terrain through multiple heads.
Yeah, I mean, this is super fascinating. I think the potentials of how we build robotics based on these different physiologies, I think it's super interesting. And I definitely want to follow the work that you guys are doing in that because I hadn't come across it before. And then in terms of ethics, you've said, and I listened to some other interviews you did, that one of the most challenging things when people come across this work is if they've, let's say, become vegetarian or vegan, right? And they're like, oh, I've stopped, you know, animal suffering.
Now what?
And I've always kind of thought about this in terms of like, you know, maybe they suffer differently, but like tomatoes that have been grown in a monoculture sprayed with chemicals equally damage the earth. Or the act of harvesting from life in general entails some violence, whether it's for a cabbage or a pig. Like, obviously, we are a lot more attuned and, you know, we see the suffering of our mammalian kin as like abhorrent. But I don't think it's such a stretch of the imagination to imagine that we also do this with the plants. And so I think the question becomes more like, what's the right relationship with all species and beings? Because we will eat and maybe we're vegetarian, maybe we're not. But what's the right relationship versus like a speciesism in terms of what we eat and consume?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it looks like a red herring, but this, I think, is way simpler once you think about it from a different perspective. We are obsessed. You mentioned something earlier about divisions, about frontiers, lines we draw. Mm-hmm. We are obsessed with categorizing, dividing, subdividing, establishing classifications. We are obsessed with belonging here or there, as if the ethical dilemma emerged by default if you belong to the animal kingdom, and doesn't emerge by default if you don't belong to the animal kingdom. Yeah. But what is a kingdom? I mean, kingdoms are abstractions. They don't exist.
True.
Well, in fact, we forget that we are not animals. We are holobionts. A holobiont is a constitution of many different forms of life. Think of the macrobiota in your gut, mm-hmm. right? So we are constituted by human cells, bacteria, viruses, so all sorts of things. We forget that we are not truly made exclusively of animal cells, mm-hmm. right? So if we took this other perspective, we would understand that what really counts, if we forget about dividing the tree of life in kingdoms, is whichever form of life ends up on my table, in my dish, whether we have inflicted to eat prior to becoming my meal any form of stress that wasn't truly needed, that wasn't necessary. And that doesn't have anything to do with being plant or animal. This is not plant versus animal, because you might be inflicting unnecessary forms of stress to those tomatoes, to those cabbages, to those greens in my plate, and maybe have some meat that during its life went through a pretty, you know, decent form of life, mm-hmm. as opposed to intensive farming and stuff like this. So it's not the kingdom of origin. It's not the kingdom of origin as such, but what is it that we have done to those life forms prior to becoming my food that it wasn't really needed after all? So this is not idealizing, thinking of a utopic world in which, no, this is like facing reality the way it is. But why do you need to be doing that before this ends up being on my dish? And to me, regardless of the choices we all make, it could be diet or it could be any other issue, think of domestic animals. I mean, there's an issue with that as well. Some people tell me, oh, I don't see any indoor plants in your place when we zoom or something like this, right? I say, well, I have a lot of plants in my orchard, mm-hmm. orange trees, olive trees, and, you know, wild plants, weeds that I don't pluck. I like to see what they do. Some of them are twining onto the orange trees because, by the way, when we think about domesticated plants, we forget that weeds are so smart. We pluck them and pluck them and pluck them and they do better and better and better, right? Mm-hmm. So are there forms of domestication that are not truly needed? Are we spoiling our pets unnecessarily? That also raises ethical dilemmas. But that's not something about being an animal or being a plant. This question can be set neutrally. So are you spoiling unnecessarily that form of life that has been domesticated? Could be a plant, could mm-hmm. be an animal, could be a fungus, could be a bacteria.
I think we need a lot of patience and gentleness with ourselves in this, because the more that you become aware of what we've been discussing, and okay, maybe there are these forms of sensitivity and intelligence in other kingdoms, quote unquote, of life that we don't know. The more, you know, we feel this compassion, this empathy, this care, and the more it becomes really difficult to live in, like, you know, 2024 neoliberal capitalism. You know, it's very hard for me when I'm not in certain places to know exactly where my food's coming from, how those plants have lived. And so I think it's an important step for us to...
Well, to be informed.
Yeah, and being informed creates stress in a way, at least it does in me and some of the people I know, because... The more that you know, the more it's like...
The more information you have, the worse.
Yeah, it's like it's hard to like be a human today, isn't it? And to make the right decisions, then you get overwhelmed. And so I think it's just, it's important to note that these are like important steps in evolution that are also returning to a worldview, but abetted by the science, which actually brings even more fascination and awe. And that, you know, listeners and just... you know, people in general out there, it's okay that it's super confusing initially, and everyone will find their right path on how to handle that information and live with it in a way that you feel okay with yourself. And you're going to be imperfect all the time, all the time.
Sure, sure.
Right?
Sure. Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. So one thing, though, I'm complete with you. I'm on the same page here. But to me, what really worries me is the fact that we sometimes, well, sometimes 99% of the times, are more eager, more sympathetic, find it easier to empathize with life forms that happen to be similar to us. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even in the case of robots, I mean, think of these Japanese robots. What do? They draw these eyelids, and then the robot does like this. Oh, he's winking or smiling, whatever, facial expression. And you don't need any of that for the robot to operate properly. It's just a matter of making it look like humans, humanoids. Mm-hmm. And that way, it looks like it's easier for us to empathize. And for many kids growing up in these high-tech environments, they empathize way more with these gadgets than they do with animals, if they happen to look less similar to the prototypical image we have of ourselves. So superficial resemblance shouldn't be what triggers empathy, the development of empathy. Mm-hmm. Scientific knowledge should be part of it. Mm-hmm. Because if a life form that doesn't resemble us at all, we find out that, oh, it's resorting to the same neurotransmitters, same molecules, same signaling pathways, being stressed under the same forms of, you know, unexpected breakups of the light cycles or day-night cycle, whatever. So if all these things that could go wrong affect them equally, and yet they don't resemble us, is that a reason not to empathize with them?
Yeah.
What is their fault that they don't resemble us?
And I think it actually, at least for me, it's made the world a much more spectacular place to go there than not to go there. So Paco, I just want to say thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, yeah, me too. And there was a quote from your book I wanted to end with. If we privilege animal and especially human channels of knowing communication, we will miss the bulk of the meaning in the natural world around us. And so again, I think why this matters is that, and you mentioned it too, is, you know, if we want to create a sustainable future, we need this awareness. We need to regain this connection with the co-inhabitants of our planet. And so, like, that's why this whole conversation actually matters, I think, at the end of the day.
Fingers crossed. We will get there eventually.
Yeah, we will.
Now, thank you so much. That was really nice.
Thank you.